This is 4:55 on October 17th. Correction, this is 4:55 on October 21st.
Okay, start. Spark attendance this morning, please. I don't know what's going on. I was asked to let people know about the computer security group here this evening is going to sponsor a talk on the math of the RSA encryption system. I don't know a whole lot more about it than that. Matt said that the speaker is someone who's well known in the black hat and white hat community, but I don't know anything more about it than that. But anyway, pardon?
Well known at WSU.
Well known at WSU. Okay. 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 John Ryan. Okay. So, 6 o'clock in this room tonight. And I don't think I can be here, but I would be if I could. Any questions? All right. So we'll continue. Remember, there's an assignment due on Friday. Turn it in on the website by 5 o'clock, please, for this one, because we need to get it in Vic's hands so he can give you some feedback about it on Monday before the exam. Okay, so where we left off last time, we were talking about the pure... We had talked about slotted Aloha and seen that it had sort of efficiency in the limit of about 37%. Then we moved on to talk about pure Aloha, which didn't have the synchronized boundaries between the slots, and saw that the efficiency got even worse. So what were the issues? The issue mostly was that the a node that was sending on the medium would just keep going in the presence of a collision. And so we then move on to carrier sense multiple access, where nodes listen before they transmit, and then we'll add a CD at the end where they stop transmitting when a collision occurs. So we'll start with this and then move on to the next step. So far we have just nodes broadcasting in this broadcast medium. If interference occurs, they detect the collision and don't accept the data, of course, but otherwise they're just pretty inefficient about this. So carrier sense means listen to see if somebody's already using the channel and don't transmit if they are. Right? So there's some diagrams in the book that I just want to go over to make sure that everybody understands how they work. They're a space-time diagram, and what they're intended to show is where and when the signal associated with a particular transmission is hearable on the network. So the idea here is that node B starts to send it. The nodes in the network are sort of spaced out like so. Node B, when it starts to send, well, it takes time for its signal to propagate in space. And so at the time when it starts to send, nobody else can know that he's sending. But sometime later, the signal has propagated out to the other nodes, and it takes time to get there. Okay, so that's just looking at the yellow piece here. If sometime later node D starts to send, well, its signal takes some time to get where to traverse the network, and so it's only at the point where those sort of propagating wave fronts in this space-time diagram are both present that you have a detectable collision. Okay, so that's the idea of the diagram. So in the pure CSMA scheme, what goes on here is that when you get a collision, you don't stop sending until you've sent your entire packet. And notice that even in a CSMA scheme, you can get collisions because at the point here where no D starts transmitting, C's signal is not yet visible. Okay? It's only sometime later that it becomes visible. Okay? Those are kind of interesting diagrams. So let's add then collision detection to this. This is the scheme used in Ethernet. The idea is that if you detect a collision, you stop at that point and thereby not waste so much of the available bandwidth. Okay, it's. Okay. So we have a different diagram for that. Less time is wasted. Notice that there is still some time that it takes you to stop. It takes you some time to notice that somebody else's signal is there and actually shut up, but much less time than to send the whole packet. Okay, so we've talked about the partitioning protocols that did frequency division partitioning or time division partitioning, and we observed that those were really nice at a low load. If there was one sender who wanted to send, it could use the whole... Sorry. Jeez. That is wrong. Completely backwards. The partitioning protocols share efficiently when everybody wants to send. Right? They chop things up into slots and everybody gets their fair share. But at low load, any one node only has 1/n of the time available and that's all that gets used. Got it. Okay. So the random access protocols, on the other hand, are efficient at low load because a single node, if nobody interferes, if nobody causes collision, that single node can just pump out at a very high rate. But at high load, you get collisions. Collisions waste time. So the final kind of protocol here at the link layer we'll talk about is the taking turns protocol that tries to balance those two. So there are a couple ways of doing it. One is where there's a master node. We use a little bit of time on the channel for the nodes that want to send to express their desire to send. Right? So we just allocate some of the time for that. I believe the 802.11b wireless protocol has something of this flavor when operating in a environment where there's a base station. The nodes say, I've got something to send. The master then at various times invites the different nodes to send, right? And so it's up to this centralized scheduling in the master to allocate the available bandwidth among the nodes that want to send. So there is some overhead associated with that, of course. You have to have this part of the time that's reserved for doing the negotiation. It takes at least two round trip times before you can deliver your data, right? Because you first have to say, I want to send, get permission to send, and then send. And the master constitutes a single point of failure. So then if you don't want a single point of failure, you come up with backup masters and then a whole lot of issues about whether the backup master actually understands what the current master is doing at all times and whether it knows about how to take over appropriately when the master fails. So it can be done, but it gets a lot more complicated to avoid that problem. Okay, so there's another kind of taking turn protocol called token passing. And back when the Ethernet was invented, so Xerox and Intel and DEC, Digital Equipment Corporation, which no longer exists, had invented this Ethernet thing, which was a CSMA CD based protocol. And IBM was sort of left behind in all of this. They didn't have anything similar going on, and they weren't part of the arrangement with Xerox and Intel and the like. And part of the reason for that was that IBM had a better way of doing it, and that was what they called their token ring network. It wasn't ready at the time when Ethernet was, but it was better, right? And so they said to their customers, you should wait for our network, it will be better than Ethernet is. Well, it was a lot more complicated, and it took quite a while to come to market, and it may have been better, but it was more expensive. So basically Ethernet won in that race. There still are token passing networks around, but not the IBM token ring anymore. Now, I don't think anybody uses that anymore. But the some of the high-speed fiber optic backbone communications runs on things called sonnet rings, and they use an idea like this. So here's how it goes. There is a set of bits called a token, and when a node holds the token, it's allowed to transmit, and when it doesn't, it has to be silent. Okay, and this set of bits gets passed around as a special bit pattern from one node to the next. So basically that's all there is to it. It has the advantage that there never are any collisions. It has the disadvantage that if you don't have anything to send, it does nevertheless take time to pass the token through nodes. So again, we're using a bit of the available bandwidth for token passing, both the time to transmit the token and the time to wait for it to come around to somebody in any given cycle. Okay, one of the concerns with the tokens is, excuse me, that a node may be defective and receive the token but not produce it to its neighbor. And that actually turns out to be one of the reasons that the token ring technology was more expensive, because you have to figure out what it is that you have to do. You have to figure out how to regenerate the token if it gets lost. And that turns into a distributed computing problem, because you don't want everybody on the network to regenerate the token, because if you ever get two tokens, then the network doesn't work at all. So anyway, token passing exists. It's a valid way of doing things, but just know that in comparison to the completely distributed Ethernet approach to things, token passing has this problem of a point of failure and the need to have a fairly complicated distributed algorithm to recover if it ever disappears. Okay. Questions about this? So I think this is the last thing on the sort of kinds of MAC protocols. What we're going to do from here is we're going to talk about addressing at the link layer, and then we'll come back and talk about Ethernet and how Ethernet specifically works. It's a little bit strange order, but okay. I think I would have done it the other way around, but maybe not. So, section 5.4, link layer addressing. So we've got, you know, think back to the protocol stack. We've got IP addresses, they belong at the network layer, right? That's where we introduce them. They're good enough to say, sort of in a global sense, I send a datagram and it gets delivered halfway across the world to another host. Right? It specifically identifies another host halfway across the world. Link layer stuff is almost always much more local than that. You have, say, an Ethernet in a building or a campus or something, or just between two points, even. So there's no need for addresses in the link layer that can address things halfway across the world in organizations you know nothing about. The other thing about link layer addresses is that although IP is maybe a predominant protocol in the networking layer, it's not the only protocol in the networking layer. So if you're a builder of, you want it to work not just with IP addresses, but also with other kinds of network layer addresses that may exist now or in the future. So it then becomes a problem of, all right, halfway across the world, somebody sent me a IP datagram. It's come all the way across the world, and now it has to be delivered to my host. How are we going to identify my host, which has a link layer address, with a particular IP address? Okay. So to solve that problem, way back early on, at the point when the Ethernet was designed, a pretty good decision was made, and that was to associate a unique 48-bit identifier with every interface device as it was manufactured, the point it was manufactured. Part of the hardware in some way burned into a read-only memory. So in some way, 48-bit address, guaranteed unique. there have been some failures of that. So 48 bits is now 64K times 2 to the 32, right? It's 2 to the 16th times 2 to the 32. So it's like 256 trillion addresses available in that space. So there's plenty of space. And I think this next slide, no, does it not say? Well, it doesn't say it there. The way it works is a manufacturer of these devices gets assigned a block of addresses. Basically, they go to the IEEE and say, I need some addresses for making network devices, and IEEE assigns them a block of addresses. They use them until they're all gone, then they go get some more, and given that there are 256 trillion of them, they won't run out. Okay. Okay. So, with that background, we see that every device on a particular link has a unique LAN address, MAC address, and sort of arbitrarily, the all ones address has been assigned to mean broadcast at the link layer level. Oh, well, okay, this is a somewhat interesting point here. Because the MAC addresses are sort of all chosen from the same 48-bit space, they really don't mean anything outside of the link layer on which they occur, but that binding to the link layer on which they occur is achieved simply by plugging it in, right? So you can take these devices and move them anywhere and plug them in. and they'll still be unique, and they'll still work at the link layer. You can't do that with an IP address, right? Because an IP address has all sorts of implications about where this device sits in the global internet. Routing works on the subnet piece of that, not on the host piece. So you can't move IP addresses around. But now we face the question of how do we get from an IP address to a MAC address? Finally, you're going to face up to that. The answer lies in something called the Address Resolution Protocol, which we typically pronounce ARP. There's also something called reverse ARP, but ARP is the one we really depend on extensively in the networking world. So the way it works is that every device sitting on a particular link layer keeps a table that maps IP addresses that belong on that link layer to MAC addresses on that link layer. Okay. And it's really just a table of hints. If you find an IP address in the table, then you have the MAC address you need. If you don't find it, then there's a protocol, this address resolution protocol, for adding it. So typically, in a host, you'll only see a handful of entries in this ARP table, except unless, of course, you're a router, say. The router is going to have to know about everybody pretty much on the LAN. And the other thing about this table is that because bindings between IP addresses and MAC addresses can change, you don't want it to be sort of too solidly locked down. So that leads to the idea of something called soft state, which is state in a machine that, if it doesn't get refreshed after a certain period of time, just disappears. Okay, and then we have a protocol for putting it back if we need it. On to the next slide. So, here, this is the protocol piece, right? We said if we had it in the table, we knew what to do. But if we don't have it in the table, then what do we do? So, the idea is that A wants to send to B, and we don't know B's MAC address. So, we use the broadcast feature of the network to send a request, a so-called ARP request, to all of the devices on the network, basically saying, in that request it says, hey, device whose IP address, say, is so-and-so, please tell me your MAC address. Okay? So that's what this says here. We send to the broadcast MAC address, everybody gets it, and the one who knows, the one who is address, IP address B, replies with its own MAC address in another ARP reply packet. And notice that it doesn't need to broadcast because it already knows A's MAC address because it received a link layer packet to do this. This slide actually leaves off something. So A has got this reply back from B that now tells it what to put in its ARP table. And interestingly, B also knows A's IP address at this point. So it puts it in its ARP table. And this is kind of cool, because why did A want B's MAC address? Well, wanted to send it an IP packet. And the usual case is that when A sends B an IP packet, it expects an IP packet in reply. So this ARP protocol not only tells A B's MAC address, it also tells B A's MAC address. And so we're set up for that that interaction with just one exchange. Okay, well, suppose that we now have a situation where a much more typical situation where A and B are on different subnets with a router in between. Nothing really changes. The story just gets a little longer. And I think that story's on the next page. Okay. So essentially we tell the story twice, right? A wants to send to B. A realizes that B is not on its local net from the IP address and says, I have to send it to a router. What router should I send it to? We'll figure that out. At the network layer. Okay. Now, A still has the problem of it has to get the packet to the router. How does it do that? Well, it has to get the router's MAC address. It uses ARP to do that. So A uses ARP to get the router's MAC address and then sends the network layer packet encapsulated in a link layer frame to R. Okay? When R gets that frame, it tears it apart to get out the network layer piece. Being a router, that's where it works, is at the network layer. Says, okay, where's it going? At the network layer, that lets it choose which interface it's going to use. It may have more than one, but that's routing. We talked about that before. And once it's chosen an interface, it says, do I know the MAC address for the ultimate destination here? If not, I'll use ARP to do it, and so on. So as the authors say, this is an important example. It sort of encapsulates the whole question of how a packet gets turned into a frame and turned back into a packet and then into another frame as it traverses over the internet to its ultimate destination. Any questions about this? Nope. Okay. So I thought I'd be brave and see what. Whoa. No entries in the ARP table. Okay. But suppose I say ping and now say what's in the ARP table. Oh. Yeah, it's doing DNS lookups. Yeah. Yeah. So the ARP command on Unix, this works the same way on Windows. Says, tell me the routing table. It can also let you change the routing table, but minus A says, just tell me the routing table. The ARP table. So when I do that ping, notice that nothing about google.com is here. Right. 134.121, 127.254 is the router that had to handle those packets, those internet packets. It's local. It's here on the WSU wireless network, and it has this as its MAC address. So that's, and given that this is on the wireless network, I really don't know any other hosts that might be here. But you know, there one of the ARP can be used for interesting things. Like, if you're on an Ethernet and you want to know what hosts are actually present on the Ethernet, even if some of them are configured not to respond to pings, you can try to ping them and then look at the ARP table and see who replied. Because even if they're configured not to respond to pings, they still have to respond to ARPs. Or they can't do anything at all. So this is kind of a sneaky way to find out who's on your Ethernet. It's entirely legit, right? You're not doing anything out of the ordinary. You could just be in a loop and try to ping each of the hosts in turn and look at the ARP table to see who responded, not to the pings, but to the ARPs. Yeah.
So if we're being sneaky, is there any way to turn it off and respond to ARPs without completely breaking everything?
To turn off responding to ARPs? To really go underground. Something you could do, but it would still be revealing your identity. And not if you want to get IP replies to anything. You can certainly sit there on the network and lurk without replying to ARPs. And you can even send stuff. No, you can't even really send stuff because you could lie. All right. So you could send lying ARP requests that didn't reveal your MAC address, your correct IP address. Wouldn't have to reveal anything, actually. It has to reveal your MAC address if you're going to get an ARP reply. But, okay.
So just change your MAC address temporarily?
You could change your MAC address temporarily for that purpose or something. That would work. Okay, so that's the ARP command. Now the question is, we haven't talked about Wireshark in here previously. But Wireshark is a program that's available for both Windows and Linux and BSD, Unix, and all kinds of other things that has the ability to capture packets off of the link layer and reveal their contents to you. Now, I'm not sure it's going to work here because often wireless devices are not able to capture things. But we'll try. All right. So I think it's probably configured at the moment not to show us what's happening. Yeah, it's not seeing anything. And it may still not see anything. I'll have to bring in... There it is. Oh, how about that? It worked. I'll have to bring in... Ethernet cable here and show you what's going on the Ethernet at some point. But so Wireshark captures, and it's still capturing, isn't it? Let me make it stop. Thank you. It captures the link layer stuff that's going on, and let me scroll this up. Need to see all the packets. Tells you when it happened, how big it is. Can do a lot of neat things with this. It shows you the link layer encapsulation. We're at a low enough resolution here on the screen that it isn't quite so impressive, but you can see You could see that it actually even knows something about the groups of MAC addresses that have been given to different manufacturers. So here it says that it's an Intel, I don't know what core stands for. Oh, probably Core 2, Intel Core architecture interface, with the low order part being like so, and that the destination MAC address is assigned to Cisco. Can figure out that it's an IP packet in there, and then show you about things at the network layer and at the transport layer, and even that in fact what was going on was a DNS query and what that looked like. Okay? What that looks like is I was asking about google.com. All right, so Wireshark is a tool for getting packets off the length layer and sort of stripping them of sort of all their information and showing them to you in a human intelligible form. It also will show you the frame in hex. If it doesn't understand something, it may not show up in this middle pane, but if you know something that it doesn't know, you can study the hex bytes and figure out maybe what you want to know. Any questions about this? In some situations, using a tool like Wireshark on a network is considered somewhere between bad form and active attacking, right? So you can get in trouble for it in some situations. I think around the university, kind of squishy. I don't hesitate to do it in class. And I think if you were only doing it for intellectual investigation of networking, you'd have a okay case, but I certainly wouldn't use it to try to find passwords for people, because of course these are the raw packets and people send passwords in packets, and using that would be a bad, bad thing.
Well,
yeah.
I think by default you're only going to see traffic coming to and from your own PC, so...
We'll talk about that when we get to talking about switched networks. Certainly some on the wireless networks, you can see a lot more than that.
But it should be encrypted, so you have to
unencrypt. Stuff at the higher levels should be encrypted if you're on the WSU wireless networks, but not all networks are. So, and then, like I said, a lot of wireless interfaces don't play very well with the sort of programming interface that is used for this capture, and you don't see anything like here. I'm only seeing traffic to my own machine, so no issue at all about that. Under Windows, you can, revealing something here. Under Windows, you can often get around the fact that the wireless device does not support the programming interface for so-called promiscuous snooping by attaching it into the bridge interface that's available, and bridging it, doing bridging, and then doing snooping on the bridge interface. You can get around this limitation of the devices. I don't know similarly in Unix what to do, but probably something similar would work.
How do other hosts tell that you're listening and promiscuous?
Now, that's an interesting question. I have heard that that is detectable, but I don't know what.
I thought that was the only way they could tell you were listening in on everything.
Right. Well, that's what I don't know. I've heard that it is possible for them to tell, but I don't know how they do it. You know, Jack? You can probably Google on that and find out. But I don't know. I think it involves tricking the host into doing something that it wouldn't do if it weren't. But I haven't thought about what that might be. Okay, well, we may come back and look at that, some more of those later. But it's a really handy tool. The other use for it is that for TCP performance analysis, it actually has some tools that will show you the sent packets and the acknowledgments and how things progress in time, and you can discover lost packets and the like using those graphical tools. But I'll leave that to you to explore. It's here. It's not in this tool, is it? It's in this tool. Surprisingly, surprisingly, it's not called a tool. It's called a flow graph. And you can explore that. Every good networker should know about Wireshark. So. All right. So then, come back here. Good. Okay. So now we turn to Ethernet. So this was a device that was invented at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center in the early 1970s by a guy named Robert Metcalf. He sort of sketched the idea on a napkin. It was one of the great invention stories of sitting and talking with somebody and sketching the idea on a napkin over lunch. So he had this idea that said, what if we had a long piece of coax and we could sort of tap into that coaxial cable? You know what I mean by coaxial cable? It's that black stuff that is used for TV. It's got a center conductor and a braided shield around the outside. And he figured out sort of mechanically that he could build a device that would sort of reach in and touch the center conductor and not short out to the shield in the process, and then have something else that touched the shield, and that would make an electrical connection into this coax. And some electronics there at the point where that happened, and a cable coming back to the computer where it was attached. And he had read enough about the Aloha stuff to sort of have figured out this idea of CSMA/CD in the process, and so that was what became Ethernet. And at the early on one was a 3 megabit per second design that ran over coaxial cable that was probably 3/8 to a 1/2 inch in diameter, so-called thick. That became what was known as ThickNet, and it used this mechanical system of sticking something through the coax, physically sort of probing into the coax. And unfortunately, I had to put up with that at Park for 12 years. While I was there, it didn't go away from Park until 1998, I think. That 3 megabit and 10 megabit thick net stuff. So other people got involved in that besides Xerox, and pretty soon we had 10 megabit per second Ethernet that ran over thin coax with connectors on the ends, and you sort of connected the interface device into the coax by using connectors. The connectors were more expensive than the probe, but the cable was so much less expensive, and it had so many other endearing characteristics, like not having transceivers that shorted out the coax, and then you had to sort of tear through the ceiling or the floor to find the place that the problem was, that became very attractive. And then after that, somebody figured out how to make it actually run over wiring, telephone wiring that already existed in buildings, so you didn't have to run a whole new set of cabling for your network. And it was at that point that Ethernet sort of had won, right? There was no stopping after that. The token ring stuff still required special wiring closets and the like, and all of a sudden Ethernet was able to run over wiring that was already there. So it just kept getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So here it says $20 for a NIC. I suspect that these days, if you go out to the discount suppliers, you can get PCI NICs for under $10. And when it's built onto a motherboard, I'd be surprised if it costs more than two, maybe more than one, right? So it's really cheap. Really cheap networking, and at that, you know, at some point it just becomes something that it's so cheap that nobody would consider building a machine that didn't have it, and that happened sometime in the last 10 years, I'd say. That we stopped buying interface cards and just started having Ethernet on motherboards, and now for laptops, for wireless Ethernet, it's become cheap enough that you put the wireless Ethernet in the laptop by default and don't make people buy exterior pieces. There's just nothing to be won economically by doing that. Okay, so the coaxial cable versions, either the thick net or the thin net, looked like this, essentially. There's a bus with the all the hosts connected to the bus. And on that bus, you have essentially those collision diagrams going on all the time, right, that we showed earlier with the red and the yellow. So when one host starts to send, sometime later other hosts see it and avoid sending, and if they start sending before it gets there, then you have a collision, you do the collision stuff. These days, well, we actually went through a intermediate step here that looked like, intermediate step had what was called a hub here instead of a switch. Essentially, the idea of the hub is to collapse all of the collision domain stuff down into about 6 inches. And so you still have the bus idea, but it all takes place inside a single box with all the hosts hooking up to that. This star topology sort of came about at the same time as the Ethernet over telephone wires, so-called Ethernet over twisted pairs, because think about how telephones are wired. You have a telephone in your office. There's a wire that goes from there back to a central room, and that all the offices in a neighborhood do that. It's natural to just put a device there and hook them all up at that point in this so-called star topology. So today we use switches here in the center of the network instead of hubs, and we'll talk about how that works next time. Okay? stop at this point. Questions while I'm at it? Very good. Thanks.